Most people think they know all they need to know about Christian rock.
Whether you think it's cheesy propaganda pretending to be cool,
or if you think it's the only pop music unsullied by worldly vices,
you'll find something to love on Rock That Doesn't Roll.
I'm Leah Payne, author of A History of Contemporary Christian Music.
And I'm Andrew Gill, a public radio producer who grew up on Christian rock.
On Rock That Doesn't Roll, we're talking with people who loved Christian rock in its peak era and learning how it affected them as they grew up.
Listen to Rock That Doesn't Roll wherever you get your podcasts.
Keir Starmer, leader of the British Labour Party, is the new UK Prime Minister after handing a resounding election defeat to the ruling Conservatives.
Securing the party one of the biggest parliamentary majorities in British history.
I'm Carol Hills. Foreign diplomats this week met with representatives from the Taliban government in Afghanistan. This Afghan activist says it's shameful that no women were invited to the meeting. Also, Binyam Girmay, a young cyclist from Eritrea, makes history as the first black rider to win a stage of the Tour de France.
It means the world to him, but even more importantly, it means so much to all the young cyclists who are in the development process on the African continent.
All those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. Britain has a new prime minister. Keir Starmer, leader of the Labour Party, moved into 10 Downing Street after Labour won a landslide election victory.
Now we can look forward again, walk into the morning, the sunlight of hope shining once again on a country with the opportunity after 14 years to get its future back.
Outgoing Prime Minister Rishi Sunak announced his resignation as leader of the UK's Conservative Party, and he wished the new Prime Minister well. To bring us up to speed on this political transition for Britain, we go to The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry. Orla, this election is being described as historic for several reasons. What are the big ones? I mean, talk us through the dramatic moments and surprises as the results came in last night.
Yes, well, let's start with the success stories, maybe, Carl. We had Keir Starmer effectively turning the party around in record time from a massive defeat 5 years ago under Jeremy Corbyn to, in the last 24 hours, securing the party one of the biggest parliamentary majorities in British history. And outside Downing Street earlier, actually, when Starmer was walking up Downing Street to go into number 10, it all happens very, very quickly in Britain. Labour activists were standing on the side of the street with tears coming down their faces. But the Starmer you play there in the intro, he sounded very, you know, poetic and jubilant, etc. His speech outside 10 Downing Street was less so.
If you voted Labour yesterday, we will carry the responsibility of your trust as we rebuild our country. But whether you voted Labour or not, in fact, especially if you did not, I say to you directly, my government will serve you.
Now, just hours before that, Carl, Rishi Sunak stood at that very same position making his resignation speech. And there's no glossing up how bad it was for the Conservatives last night. Nearly two-thirds of Tory MPs have lost their seats, including many members of his cabinet, the Defence Secretary, the Education Secretary, the Culture Secretary. They've all lost their seats. And most notably, maybe for many in the UK, the former Prime Minister, Liz Truss, who was in power for 49 whole days and managed to set off a financial crisis during her time in office. She was booted out by British voters as well last night. But Rishi Sunak, to be fair, he didn't try and dress up the defeat for his party either when he was speaking outside number 10 earlier.
I have heard your anger, your disappointment, and I take responsibility for this loss. To all the Conservative candidates and campaigners who worked tirelessly but without success, I'm sorry.
Orla, it's not going to be easy for Keir Starmer to govern, though, is it? I mean, Nigel Farage and his far-right party did relatively well, and Farage is notably an ally of Donald Trump. How significant is it that Farage's party has won a number of seats in Parliament?
it's significant. It's significant. I mean, the number of seats they won is small, only 4 seats, but that's because the way the voting system works in the UK, it's this first past the post system. But their vote share was much greater. They secured around 14% of the vote in Britain, and that's a lot for a new small party. And a lot of the votes they took was from Conservative candidates. Nigel Farage also won a seat for the first time, his 8th attempt at winning a seat in Parliament. But in his victory speech this morning, his word of warning was that they're going for the Labour Party.
This Labour government will be in trouble very, very quickly. We will now be targeting Labour votes. We're coming for Labour, be in no doubt about that.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, when the celebrations are over for the Labour Party, there is still the matter of actually running the country. What sort of challenges will Starmer be facing?
Yeah, we have to bear in mind, of course, a huge part of the success of the Labour result was thanks to the fury many members of the public feel towards the Conservatives. People are really angry at the state of how they see things in Britain right now, from the cost of living crisis to the state of the NHS, etc. Keir Starmer talked about it in his speech at 10 Downing Street. You know, he said, we have some really challenging issues ahead. We really need to get the NHS back on its feet. But he also said that changing a country is not like flicking a switch. You know, he acknowledged that this is going to take time, and I'm not sure if the British public have that much patience in them.
And what about relations between the UK and the US, the special relationship? What are those likely to look like with Starmer now as Prime Minister?
I mean, I think the reality is it will likely be business as usual. The two countries have managed to work fairly successfully together, despite who has been in the White House in the past. Keir Starmer, we know, has been quite cautious about commenting on either President Biden or Donald Trump in recent times. Following the US presidential debate last week, he didn't comment on President Biden's performance. And after the hush money conviction of Donald Trump in May, Starmer was also asked his thoughts, and he said he was prepared to work with whoever is elected to the White House come November. So far, we haven't heard anything from President Biden about Keir Starmer's election success. Donald Trump last night did post congratulations, but not to Keir Starmer, but to Nigel Farage. And we do know that next week, Keir Starmer is scheduled to attend the NATO summit in Washington, where presumably he will have his first official meeting with the US president as the British Prime Minister.
Always a pleasure. The world's Orla Barry. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Carl.
Sticking with elections in Europe, France is headed into a second round of snap parliamentary elections this weekend. On the campaign trail, more than 50 candidates and French political figures have been physically attacked. Most recently, a government spokeswoman, her deputy, and a party activist were assaulted while putting up posters. French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said the candidates who'd been attacked represent the left and the right. Around 30,000 police officers will be deployed on Sunday for voters. Safety. We'll have the results and analysis for you right here on Monday. If you think you don't know any Swahili, think again.
Hakuna Matata, ain't no peasant craze. It means no worries.
As Disney's The Lion King once said, Hakuna Matata means no worries in Swahili, or Kiswahili, as it's called locally. This is a language that's grown to become one of the 10 most widely spoken languages in the world. As the world's Africa correspondent, Halima Gakandi, reports from Mombasa, Kenya, July 7th has been designated World Kiswahili Day by the United Nations.
The city of Mombasa lies along what is called the Swahili Coast, an area that stretches from southern Somalia all the way down to northern Mozambique. Kimani Njogu is a longtime Swahili advocate and expert. He tells me how this area got its name from an Arabic-speaking adventurer.
Ibn Battuta, who was an explorer, came to the East African coast, and he saw people along the coast, and he called them Swahili, or Sawahil, which is basically people who live on the coast.
Along this coast, through the intermixing of locals with traders from far-off lands, the language of Swahili emerged.
Swahili is a Bantu language, which has borrowed substantially from other world languages, as all languages do, on account of contact. It has borrowed from Arabic, it's borrowed from Persian, it's borrowed from Hindi, from Portuguese, from English.
Trade, conflict, and migration over hundreds of years has helped Swahili grow into a language now spoken by more than 200 million people across eastern and southern Africa. It is one of the official languages of the African Union, and its growing importance is why the United Nations designated Sunday as World Kiswahili Day. At the Swahili Cultural Center in downtown Mombasa, Kenyan school children are showing off their language skills as part of the World Kiswahili Day celebrations. One student, Mwanamisi Juma Karisa, stands out with a song about the beauty of the Swahili language. I sang today because I love Swahili, she tells me. More people should learn it. Swahili is one of more than 60 languages spoken in Kenya. It is the only official language other than English. In Kenya, it's a required second language. But Kenyan attitudes towards Swahili haven't always been positive, says Professor Leonard Mwaka of Howard University.
They have negative languages towards African languages in general. They marginalize them and prioritize English. And so if you don't speak English, they think you're not educated.
But Mwaka says this attitude is changing, especially as interest in learning Swahili grows internationally. In the United States, for example, the government is funding language programs. I met with Mwaka at a local university where he's overseeing a Swahili immersion program for American students.
A lot of times we had students who were learning Swahili because of either a language requirement or a career, goal. But over the years, especially in the recent past, I'm beginning to see a lot of heritage learners.
Daryl Ndungu Lloyd is one of those students who has a cultural connection to Swahili. His father is Kenyan, and he even studied in Kenya for a few years. But he didn't get a chance to learn Swahili at the international school he attended.
It was discouraged for you to, speak Swahili in the school. They kind of reinforce the idea that, it's more beneficial for you to learn German or French or Spanish because that apparently would now further your career.
Now that he's older, he has realized how important Swahili is to his goal of becoming a diplomat. He wants to help solve conflicts in East Africa.
So it's crazy to say that I picked up the majority of my Swahili at my school in Southeast Ohio. So yes, it's very strange.
In the university's kitchen, students are learning to cook some local dishes. Neha Sridhar is a linguistic major from the University of Kansas.
It's a really great language to learn because you can communicate with so many people. It's a very large language that people just aren't aware of, I think, in America, since there's not as many diasporas there.
But the number of immigrants from Swahili-speaking countries has also grown over the years. That's something Christopher Matthews has seen firsthand. He's a recent graduate of the University of Pittsburgh. As a student, he used to volunteer with Swahili-speaking refugees.
The reactions that you get from people when you're able to communicate with them in their language are so, so incredible. And that's anything from a few greetings to being able to have a fluent conversation.
One of the positive sides of Swahili, he adds, is that it is relatively easier to learn for people who speak English as a first language.
The language is just fun. It follows a lot of rules, so if you're used to irregularities in language, Swahili is a great change of pace.
For Serafina Atibu of Howard University, it is really gratifying for her to see the growing interest in the language. Swahili was actually her first language. She's Congolese and grew up at a refugee camp in Kenya, but she lost a lot of her language abilities when she moved to the United States.
It kind of gives it a sense of power and a sense of value to know that it's not just us that sees the goodness and the greatness to it, but there's also it's getting recognition from outside as well.
She adds that she is excited to be in Kenya to celebrate World Kiswahili Day on Sunday.
Napenda watu wa Kenya wote na ninapenda Kiswahili sana. Asante.
I love all the people of Kenya and I love Swahili a lot, she says. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Mombasa.
Hurricane Beryl made landfall early this morning on Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula. By the time it landed, it had been downgraded to a Category 2 storm. But earlier this week, Beryl broke records as the earliest Category 5 hurricane to cross the Atlantic. It smashed through Grenada, nearly flattening two of its smaller islands. Then it battered Jamaica and the Cayman Islands. The storm has killed at least 10 people across the Caribbean. Hurricane Beryl is weakening, but forecasters say it might pick up steam again as it crosses over the Gulf of Mexico. The storm could hit South Texas by early Monday morning. You're with the world.
Hey there. I've got a quick favor to ask you. We are doing a listener survey to learn more about how you listen, what you like about our show, and maybe what we could improve on. It takes about 2 minutes to fill out, and we would be grateful if you did. You can find that survey at survey.prx.org/world. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Diplomats from some 20 nations met this week with representatives of Afghanistan's Taliban government. The gathering took place in Doha, the capital of Qatar. It's part of an effort called the Doha Process, set up by the United Nations to help solve Afghanistan's many problems. But Afghan women were not invited to these talks. That's something the Taliban insisted upon. The ultra-conservative group has sidelined women from Afghan society since coming to power again in 2021. The world's Shirin Jafari has been speaking with some of these women to get their reactions to the talks.
Reporters confronted the Taliban officials when they arrived at the venue in Doha. Why are you afraid of women? One of them asks. Why don't you answer our questions? The reporters follow the men, who are in their traditional outfits, turbans, loose shirts, and pants. The men don't answer and pick up their pace, avoiding eye contact with the female journalists. Many Afghans and women's rights activists have been up in arms about this meeting. It's shameful that the United Nations accepted the Taliban's demand for sidelining Afghan women from this meeting, says Parwana Ibrahim Khil, an Afghan women's rights activist in Germany. Ibrahim Khil was among a group of women who took part in protests in Afghanistan following the takeover of the country by the Taliban. She chanted slogans and demanded that women be allowed to go to school. But her activism came at a cost. In January 22, she was arrested and jailed. Ibrahim Khil says she was held in solitary confinement for about a month. She could hear the screams of other prisoners, she says. The guards beat and tortured her. Ibrahim Khil says she was told she would be stoned to death. They wanted to destroy me, she says. Her story and that of other detained women's rights activists got a lot of international attention at the time, and that helped their release. Ibrahim Khil fled to Pakistan and from there went to Germany. She says for years, the U.S. and other Western countries said part of their mission in fighting in Afghanistan is to liberate Afghan women. But it seems like it was all a game, she says. We've lost hope and trust in them. 23-year-old Halima, who lives in Dagman province in eastern Afghanistan, says her dream of becoming a doctor was buried when the Taliban came to power. She didn't want to use her last name because she says she worries about backlash from the Taliban. She says when she hears the Taliban is sitting down with international diplomats, she feels like the world is moving on without her. UN officials have pushed back against the criticism that they are condoning the Taliban treatment of women.
Welcome to this briefing following the third meeting of the Special Envoy on Afghanistan.
After the meeting, Rosemary DiCarlo, the Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, held a press conference and said that the talks were not to legitimize the Taliban. She also said the delegates discussed women's rights.
It was a number one concern and request coming from special envoys from around the world, and it is certainly something that we raised.
She said this was an opportunity for different sides to hear each other out. No country officially recognizes the Taliban, but the U.S. wants to engage with the group about anti-terrorism and counter-narcotics efforts. As for what the Taliban say about women's rights in Afghanistan, it's an internal matter and should be resolved among Afghans, says their spokesperson, Zabihullah Mujahid. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
There's exciting news from the Tour de France this week.
Mats Pedersen, Gamay, Biniam Gamay wins his first ever stage of the Tour de France for Eritrea.
Biniam Girmay is the first black cyclist to win a stage at the world's biggest cycling race. He called his victory a win for all Africans. Kimberly Coates knows Girmay well. She's the CEO of Team Africa Rising, which works to grow the sport in the African continent. She joins us from Las Vegas. Kimberly, you know Girmay and his story. How much does this victory in the sprint stage actually mean to him?
Well, it means the world to him, but even more importantly, it means so much to all the young cyclists who are in the development process on the African continent, which are literally thousands of young kids, men and women. And it was interesting, as I was listening to that clip just now, I got so emotional because this has been years in the making. I started it in Rwanda in 2009, so this has been 15 years. And seeing the progress of somebody like Biniam make it through the ranks and make it onto the history books is huge. I can't even put it into words most days.
Wow. So you followed him from the beginning. Tell us about his backstory.
Biniam Girmay is from Eritrea, and Eritrea is a challenging country. Like most African countries, it's very difficult to get visas to places like Europe. And with cycling on the African continent, we lack access to equipment. We lack access to training in many cases. Like in the case of Eritrea, internet is very challenging. So there's a lot of advantages that European and even American cyclists have, you know, before they even get to the start line. Biniam has to overcome so much, and it makes it that much harder.
I was reading about Biniam, and I was interested to learn that cycling was already popular in Eritrea because of the Italians who'd colonized it, and they made cycling popular. So he sort of grew up watching cycling races.
100%. And I've been to Eritrea on several occasions, and there's this one road right outside of Asmara, which is the capital city, and you will literally see hundreds upon hundreds of young cyclists up and down this road training on all sorts of bikes, and you'll see all the pro jerseys amongst all these riders. So as Eritreans make it onto professional teams, there's several on pro continental and world tour teams that they give back to their local community, and you see kids wearing Intermarché jerseys and, you know, being the next Biniam Girmay or Lidl Trek jerseys. It's just amazing to watch.
I'm curious, you know how East Africa, the runners from there sort of have an advantage in international competitions because of the altitude. Is that true for cycling too? Because Biniam has been training all these years at higher altitudes. Does that really help him prepare for something like the Tour de France?
It definitely does. I think Asmara is at almost 8,000 feet. So within East Africa, whether it's Kenya, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Eritrea, most of these guys are along that Rift Valley, so they do train at altitude. I know when we lived in Rwanda, we were at about 6,700 feet. On top of that, it's not only just the altitude, it's just their natural God-given gift to be able to race at this level. So it's not a matter of do they have the talent, it's a matter of do they have access to everything they need to nurture that talent.
Kimberly Coates is the CEO of Team Africa Rising. You're listening to The World. In Iran, today's presidential runoff puts a conservative hardliner up against a more moderate reformist politician. If the reformer wins, that could end up helping the hardline Iranian regime.
It might kind of burnish the image of the Islamic Republic and, you know, make it look a little bit less totalitarian.
That story's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Economic turmoil has sparked political upheaval in many parts of the globe. Major protests erupted in Kenya and Bolivia in recent days. And over the last few months, France, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, Argentina, and other countries have seen various kinds of unrest. And one of the things fueling the blowback is rising inequality. This was also part of the story when huge protests took place in Egypt more than a decade ago. When the so-called Arab Spring began in 2011, part of the movement's soundtrack came from two people, a poet and a blind oud player, rediscovered by a new generation. Decades earlier, the two had transformed Egypt's music scene with a new kind of popular music that spoke to the masses. Their biting lyrics were a thorn in the side of the country's dictatorship. Dana Balut of the Kerning Cultures Network brings us their story.
Back in the 1960s, the El Mugi household in downtown Cairo was famous for its parties. At least once a week, a crowd would cram into its living room.
My grandmother's living room would take squeezed together maybe 20 people.
Sahad El-Mugi was just a young girl then, but she remembers the room well, and she remembers how it would fill up with poets and artists and intellectuals.
Writers, people from the radio.
And then, after everybody had arrived, these two figures would usually stand up in the crowd. One of them would pick up a oud, and the other would pull out a poem he'd prepared. Together, they'd start to perform. Their names were Sheikh Imam and Ahmad Fuad Nagim.
I used to squeeze myself into those grown-ups and just listen. Imam had this kind of genius, actually.
Sahar didn't know this at the time, but what she was watching from the floor in that room full of grown-ups was the start of a new era in Egyptian popular music.
They were very special times.
Over the next two decades, they became household names. People across the country would play their music. But the more popular they became, the more dangerous they were to the ruling party. Again and again, their songs would land them in prison. Under both the regimes of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Anwar al-Sadat, freedom of expression was closely monitored, and any criticism of state affairs, even in songs, could be a punishable offense. But to others, they were heroes, two icons who put into words the disillusionment ordinary people in Egypt had been feeling for a long time.
I think that both of them together, this artistic experiment, this thing tapped into the Egyptian psyche at a time that this psyche was very bruised. And it gave voice to this pain.
This is producer Nadine Shaker.
Sheikh Imam was born Imam Ahmed Muhammad Isa in a small village outside of Cairo in the year before the 1919 Egyptian Revolution, while the country was still under British occupation. When he was around 5 months old, he lost his eyesight and would never get it back. But he was always a keen student. By the time he was in his early teens, he was able to make money by reciting the Quran at public events. One time, a local sheikh heard him performing and encouraged him to travel to Cairo to carry on his education.
Which ultimately proves to be very short-lived.
This is historian Andrew Simon. He's the author of a book called Media of the Masses, Cassette Culture in Modern Egypt.
And so Imam is expelled from his Islamic Institute because he is caught by a fellow student who reports him to his instructors for listening to Quranic recitation over the radio at a cafe.
When Imam was expelled, he was made homeless and ended up living in a working-class neighborhood of Cairo, spending his nights sleeping in mosques. For a while, he made a meager living performing at religious festivals and weddings, or reciting the Quran at private homes for special occasions. And it was in one of these performances that he met a well-known music teacher called Sheikh Darwish al-Hariri, who took Imam under his wing as a student and started giving him formal music lessons.
And then during the course of these lessons, one of the things that happens is that Imam hears this other individual playing the oud, and he learns that the other guy playing the oud is also blind. And so this is something that shocked him, that a blind person could actually play that instrument. And so he decides to take it up. So by 1945 then, Imam ends up committing himself to his art on a full-time basis. Flash forward a number of years, 1962 arrives, and that's when he crosses paths with Ahmed Fuad Nigam, a poet who was known for writing in colloquial Egyptian Arabic. And then those two go on to form a very dynamic duo.
The two men formed a strong bond, and together they started composing and singing political songs. They even moved into the same apartment together in Cairo and dedicated everything to their music. And then, in 1967,
Israeli forces launched an all-out attack on Arab forces at the Sinai Desert.
Egypt's defeat in the Six-Day War and Israel's annexation of the Sinai Peninsula were a huge blow to Nasser's regime. But it also helped open society a bit. As people became more disillusioned with the war and Nasser's rule, they started to come together to find alternative ways to voice their dissent. Music was one example of that.
And so Nigam and Imam together end up undermining the stories that are being told by the state. And that's why they gain traction, and that's why they become icons, especially among the Egyptian left.
One other factor is that the two of them belong to a very low economic segment of society, and hence people identified.
So, translated into English, thank God we knocked beneath our armpits. How lovely that our officers have come back from the line of fire.
This is Elliot Kulla, professor of Arabic literature at Georgetown University. We asked him to talk us through Imam's song, Alhamdulillah Khabbatna, or Thank God We Knocked Beneath Our Armpits.
It begins in this kind of simple way, but already in that first couple lines you hear, they're making fun of the fact that the Egyptian army has been beaten. This poem landed those two in deep, deep trouble with the regime. This is the first time they stepped over the line, and this is part of the reason why they became first invited and then banned from state radio.
So this was when they started to become very famous. Along with this fame, earlier recordings were leaked.
This is Zain al-Abidin Fuad, a well-known Egyptian poet who often collaborated with Imam. Zain spoke to us in Arabic, and we had an actor voice his lines in English.
The security apparatus took these songs to Nasser. They were arrested and weren't released until after Nasser's death.
I mean, they were arrested and imprisoned several times throughout their lives. I mean, they were frequent flyers when it came to Egypt's prison, and they were well-known entities from the perspective of the security apparatus.
But one of their biggest hits was yet to come. In 1974, U.S. President Richard Nixon touched down in Cairo on a state visit with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat, the first visit by a U.S. head of state in decades. At home, he was embroiled in the Watergate scandal, and his impeachment hearings were well underway. When Nixon stepped out onto the tarmac at Cairo International Airport, he was greeted by a huge crowd. There was a military procession, a gaggle of media people, dignitaries, and Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat.
This was not a silent affair. And so you have Egyptians chanting things like, "We believe in Nixon, welcome to a man of peace," in Arabic. There are other chants that are sounding off in English. People saying, "Long live Sadat, long live Nixon."
But away from the crowds and the loudspeakers and the billboards, Nigam and Imam were at work.
I just imagine them sitting in a cafe, hearing about all of this commotion and festivities surrounding Nixon's visit, and then penning this poem and setting it to song and offering this completely different narrative of his welcome.
شرفت يا نكسون بابا يا بتاع الأوتر جيت عملوا لك قيمة وسيمة سلاطين الفول والزيت فرشوا لك.
Thank you for gracing us with your presence, Daddy Nixon, Mr. Watergate Man. They threw you quite a show, those sultans of fava beans and oil.
What?
They rolled out the red...
What, Yanni? Yeah, this kind of poetry, which draws a story, which draws an image, which makes fun of the American president at the time, who was coming to Egypt for an official visit. I mean, they were crazy. They were totally nuts in a great way.
The real point of this poem is not just making fun of Nixon, it's more making fun of the Egyptians who bend over backwards to host them. And the song, sort of, it's them that the song is skewering, and skewering them for being obsequious.
A couple of months after Nixon's welcome and Nixon Baba begins to circulate, Nigam, Imam, they were all arrested.
But in prison or not, their music continued to grow as part of the counterculture, especially under Sadat. It was a time when musicians became famous through TV or radio broadcast. But these were state-controlled, and there was no way they were going to play Nigma and Imam's protest music.
I mean, there was this very clear decision on the part of the decision makers not to include this kind of work in the mainstream media.
So the answer? Cassette tapes, some of which were recorded in Sahar's family home.
Tapes that are being created, copied, pirated, circulated by individuals. In the case of Imam, piracy was encouraged. And so you have people recording Imam or pirating these cassettes and then taking these cassettes to London, to Paris, Algeria, Tunisia, Lebanon, the Gulf, and then people pirating the cassettes there.
Of course, of course. Why wouldn't their tapes go to Maghreb and Algeria and Syria and have an audience? Why wouldn't it? It's the same wound, the same brokenness, the same aspirations for freedom and for justice, equality.
Everyone we spoke to said that Nigma and Imam's partnership came to an end sometime around the mid-1980s. By then, Imam was well into his 60s, but nobody knew exactly why they split up.
There is some tension between them in terms of their commitment to their work and kind of questions of celebrity and fame.
In the summer of 1995, a small article was printed in the back pages of Al Ahram newspaper, noting that Sheikh Imam has passed away. It was short and perhaps intentionally unremarkable.
And so people reading this, Imam's compatriots, his friends, his fans, were so outraged. They felt this obituary was so irreverent and insulting that they actually end up submitting a second obituary. So that's where we see Imam referred to as the artist of the people. And so that's kind of where his story, where his life wraps up.
So Sahar had kept her cassettes from Nigma and Imam's glory days, but she rarely listened to them.
It brings me back to my own history, my own childhood, my parents who are no longer there, Imam and Nigma who are not, very, very heavy and painful. However, in 2011, when there was a rebirth for Nigma and Imam, I could tune in and I could sing without pain.
In 2011, during the Egyptian Revolution, their music was revived. Lines from Nigma's poems were chanted as slogans, and Sheikh Imam's songs were covered by musicians and sung by thousands in Tahrir Square.
They were reborn to generations they didn't know about them, and with a collective voice in the squares, I was shaken, completely shaken, but not in a painful way. It was joy that I knew they would go on living. I think what they are offering us is something similar to what they offered back in the 1960s and 70s. This period, as Egyptians, we didn't have freedoms. We didn't have equality. We didn't have everything, just like today. And despite that, they wrote and they sung, people listened, and hence it's about those broken moments. No matter how dire the circumstances are, no matter how tied up we all are, a change will happen because this is the law of life. Life constantly brings about changes. الشمس غرقت في بحر الغمام ومدت على الدنيا موجة ظلام.
That was Nadine Shaker and Dana Balut of the Kerning Cultures Network telling the story of Egypt's influential musician and poet, Sheikh Imam and Ahmed Fuad Negm. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Today, Iranians went to the polls for a second round of voting to choose their next president. Two very different candidates were on the ballot in an election with voter apathy running high. The runoff election will determine who replaces Ibrahim Raisi, Iran's previous president. He died in a helicopter crash in May. Results are expected as soon as tomorrow morning. The World's Duri Buscarin reports on what's at stake.
When Arash, a 38-year-old contractor, votes today in Tehran, he'll do it quietly, in the off hours. In their media, the ruling system tends to show all the people lining up to brag about their legitimacy, Arash says. He's asked to only be identified by his first name because he's been arrested before while participating in the Woman Life Freedom protests. Many pro-democracy activists in Iran have called for a boycott of the vote, but Arash says he plans to vote for the sole reformist candidate, Masoud Pezeshkian. I'd rather play my part to have a more moderate government that will have dialogues with the world and can open up the economy a little bit, Arash says. Last week's election turnout in Iran was low, incredibly low. According to government figures, just 40% of eligible voters participated in the first round of elections, the smallest turnout rate for a presidential election in Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Two candidates made it to the runoff: Pezeshkian, a reformist parliamentarian and former heart surgeon, and Saeed Jalili, an ultra-conservative and former chief nuclear negotiator under former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Barbara Slavin is an Iran expert at the Stimson Center in Washington, D.C.
Pezeshkian has campaigned on promises that he would reduce efforts to enforce the hijab. He has also promised to try to revive the Iran nuclear accord, which is going to be a tall order, frankly. There isn't much of it left.
In contrast, she says, a Jalili administration would look a lot more like that of the late President Ebrahim Raisi.
Very hard line, people chosen for positions because of their ideological views, not because of their competence. Jalili has no managerial experience to speak of. He has very little understanding of the modern economy.
Slavin says Iran's economy is in a precarious place. Amid U.S. sanctions and political uncertainty, investors are pulling out of the stock market. Jalili has a small but devoted following.
They are very, very religious. They are very, very xenophobic, particularly when it comes to the West.
The role of the president is limited in Iran. Both Pezeshkian and Jalili had to be permitted to run by Iran's Guardian Council of clerics and jurists. And Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, still has the final say on anything.
I think, on the one hand, a win by the reformists might actually help him. It might kind of burnish the image of the Islamic Republic and, you know, make it look a little bit less totalitarian. So perhaps he would not get in the way of that. On the other hand, I think he'd be perfectly fine if Jalili wins, because then he has another loyal supporter.
In the first round, the conservative vote was split between two candidates. Now that Jalili is the only right-wing candidate remaining in the race, reformist Pezeshkian's chances hinge on capturing at least some of the voters who boycotted the polls in the first round. To get a sense of how likely that is, I went back to two of the abstaining voters who I met last week, and I asked them if their thoughts had changed. This is Milad, a young engineer. He sees the runoff as a tactic to make the government look like a functioning democracy. He won't participate. I made my decision a long time ago, and I was aware that there was a high chance that it would come to a runoff, Milad tells me through a translator. I'm determined in my decision, but I won't tell others if they should or shouldn't vote, he says. Shakayat, a freelance writer, will do the same. After years of protesting, watching elections get stolen, and still trying to get the system to change from within, she is so done. When Pezeshkian says he's going to pay attention to the needs of women, he says he'll do it within the framework of the law. But the law by itself is misogynistic, and he has no solution for that, Shakayek says. Both of these candidates are going to protect the interests of the Islamic Republic, Shakayek says. The only difference is that one of them will do it in an uglier way. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Every year, an estimated 1.2 million people die in road traffic collisions. That's according to the WHO. One big reason for those crashes? Speeding. Well, starting this weekend across Europe and in Northern Ireland, people buying new cars will notice a slew of new safety features when they drive off the lot. One of them is aimed at preventing people from driving too fast.
New vehicles will need to have intelligent speed assistance systems fitted as standard. This is part of an EU safety regulation mandate. Of course it is.
The intelligent speed assistance system combines satellite maps with a forward camera on vehicles. It will read road signs, and in Europe and Northern Ireland, the device will actually limit a driver's speed. In the UK, the device will sound an alarm if the driver is speeding. That's because the mandate doesn't apply in post-Brexit Britain. But since cars will be made for distribution Europe-wide, cars sold in Britain will be equipped with the intelligent speed assistance system. It just won't be active. Though very few believe that the UK will be immune for long.
I can see the argument for us having them, whilst at the same time hating the idea with a passion and it going against almost everything that I believe in.
That's Steve Barry, a former presenter of the BBC auto program Top Gear. He says the idea of being reined in while driving is abhorrent, but it's hard to argue against the idea that speed limits do save lives.
Oh, so you reserve the right to exceed the speed limit, do you? And it's hard to say, yeah, I do.
The sand in the egg timer is getting pretty low on the age of motoring.
This is the YouTube channel Jeff Buys Cars. As you can probably tell, Jeff and a buddy he's got with him are not happy. And not only because of the big brother nature of the speed limiters.
Using speed limiters successfully would also be a step forward in developing self-driving cars in the UK.
No.
Just no.
Just no.
Just no.
No.
Other safety features that go into effect on Sunday include some of the functions that now come standard on new cars, like automated lane keeping and autonomous emergency braking. Proponents also remind the public that keeping to the speed limit saves gas and cash. These new devices started being installed in European cars 2 years ago. Drivers were able to simply turn them off. That won't be possible anymore under the new rules. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend and join us right back here on Monday. From PRX.